Dan, you might have a strongly held different opinion about the decorum in Parliament.
Yeah, no, I need to make sure that absolutely there can be absolutely no children in Parliament at all. No, I agree with
you. You just hate children. It's got nothing to do with.
Oh yeah, this is a purely a child like hating children thing.
Welcome to the Pin Factory, the Addis with Issues podcast. My name is Matthew Lesh. I'm the head of research here at the ASI. In this week's episode, I'm joined by my co-host and head of programs, Daniel Pryor, as well as Alice Denby, the deputy editor of CapEx. In this episode, we'll be discussing Britain's borders, Boris Foster, and babies in Parliament. The tragic deaths of 27 migrants in the English Channel has spurred a renewed debate about Britain's borders, with calls to variously be more generous for refugees and redouble efforts to prevent maritime arrivals. Daniel, what do you think is driving the kind of record-breaking numbers of boats crossing the channel?
Yeah, so we've had more than 25,000 people crossing the channel so far this year. That's not actually reflected in terms of overall numbers of people seeking asylum in the UK. We've actually seen that remain fairly stable over the past few years. There was quite a significant decline when it came to lockdown and COVID, but with the gradual reopening of various routes into the UK, we've started to see them go up again. But when it comes to some of the causes for specifically these channel crossings, I think that one of them is actually a lot of the time you're going to have a situation where the UK government's doubled down on trying to make it harder to cross. And yet that hasn't really affected the overall numbers of people attempting to make the journey. All it's done is it's forced people in towards more difficult, more dangerous routes of getting into the UK. So we've had a situation where a lot of the legal routes have been closed, and that has driven the existing number of asylum seekers towards this very specific route. So it's not so much an influx in general of people seeking asylum as it is people being pushed towards this route because they don't have alternative.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is one of those routes that's closed the Dublin regulation? This is a kind of post-Brexit thing, isn't it? And this was the mechanism whereby you could apply for asylum in one country and then move to another one if you had family and so on there. And that seems to me like an obvious solution for people to apply for asylum in France, but then come to the UK safely.
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest things that's closed down. That Dublin regulation specifically provided for a family reunification route that a lot of asylum seekers previously took, and they did so. It was a kind of safe legal route that you could apply for if you had family in the UK. Then you were able to come over through a kind of regulated and legal route. But with the shutting down of that, simply as a result of Brexit, the UK left the Dublin regulation. What we have now is basically very few to no safe legal routes in. And that, of course, hasn't stopped people trying to get into the UK, because I think if you look at the motivations behind a lot of people making these sort of journeys, they're not going to be put off by a lack of safe legal routes. They're being pushed towards making this journey because either there's, you know, a lot of really bad factors in where they're coming from that are pushing them towards a new and safe country. Now, a lot of the objections that people might have to this as well, France is ostensibly a safe and legal country, so why don't they end up staying there? Well, there's a number of reasons why people might choose to come to the UK, even though actually France does get far more asylum applications than the UK, significantly more. And most asylum seekers do tend to go to their neighbouring country. They don't actually tend to go to Europe at all. The kind of overwhelming majority will stay where they can as soon as they've opted out of the country they're trying to escape from. But if you're someone who has a lot of family, friend connections in the UK, you might speak the English language. You might be able to, so for example, you might have a link to English culture through work with the army, as is the case with a lot of Afghan refugees. Then the UK seems like a much more understandable destination that you might want to go towards to seek asylum. If you know you want to be with your family and friends and have some sort of way of potentially building a new life, and for some people, at least in France, that's not offered.
Though, Daniel, there does seem to be an issue though with respect to these boat crossings. It is obviously involving a criminal gangs. It's putting people's lives at risk. You'd obviously much prefer people take documented routes rather than getting onto boats. I think what you're effectively getting at here is that, well, if only we just provide them safe legal routes, then they'll stop climbing that boat. But isn't the inherent problem here that there's just never going to be enough capacity in a safe legal route compared to the number of people who want to come to the UK? So let's say, and I completely agree with you, let's say we increased the UK's refugee intake, let's say we doubled or tripled or quadrupled, you know, made it far more generous to allow refugees to come to this country. We then double that up with making the Home Office somehow efficient and competent, and they process that quickly. Isn't just the fact that there are millions of people who want to be in the UK, who are willing to kind of sacrifice a lot to come to UK, mean that whatever you do to make it easier through legal routes, there's always going to be people trying to cross the channel and who are going to be desperate or willing to pay people smugglers. And if you want to avoid that, then you've got to also, I guess, focus on things like, you know, more traditional methods like, you know, policing the border itself.
Well, I think it's fair to say that on the margin, you're always going to have some people that are trying to make illicit crossings. I don't think anyone argues that you can completely eliminate illicit attempts to enter the UK when people might not have a good asylum claim, for example. But thinking on the margins, you don't have an infinite number of people that are both entitled to and want to claim asylum in the UK in the world. You have a finite number. And the question is, given that you have a certain number of people that want to make this journey, and the vast majority of people who arrive on these shores do have a legitimate asylum claim, how best do you reduce the amount of danger in that journey for the vast majority of them? Now, it might be that, as you say, you're not going to completely eliminate dangerous crossings, because there will always be people that maybe even with safe legal routes, they, for whatever reason, don't take them. It might be that the people who don't take those safe legal routes are ones that don't actually end up having a legitimate claim for asylum in the UK. But you're still going to have quite a huge effect on the safety of many, many people if you make these safe legal routes available. You're not going to completely stop it and kind of eliminate any danger, but you're certainly going to make a significant impact.
What do you think, Alice?
Well, I mean, I agree with you, and it's quite an attractive argument. But you say that most people who arrive on these shores have legitimate asylum claim, but they're not the case. That there are huge problems with our asylum system. I mean, there's huge numbers of people who abscond and who just disappear. There's the problem that we possibly have sort of illicit work available to people. And also that claims take so long to process. We had the Liverpool bomber who'd been waiting 7 years for a decision. You know, we need a system that's both generous and open and safe for people to come, but also effective mechanisms for sending people back who don't have a legitimate claim, for speeding up decisions and for stopping people absconding.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think a lot of the time, these sort of problems that are in our asylum system when it comes to, say, people absconding or people not working with the process of evaluating their claim, a lot of that is to do with the incentives that we've actually set up for the sort of ways that we treat people who do arrive here and awaiting results of their claim. So the kind of classic thing that's being talked about a lot in this area is the 12-month work ban that the UK puts in place while people are awaiting the results of their asylum decision. And this, by international standards, is very, very harsh. You know, France has 6 months. The vast majority of developed countries that have significant asylum applications have far lower periods before, as someone awaiting your application results, you're allowed to go out and seek employment. And if you put yourself in the position of someone who, you know, has fled, say, war in many cases, and they've arrived here with their family and they're looking to provide for them. You know, they've got to pay for food, for sanitation, for clothing, and they're on an allowance of around £5 a day on average, and they're not allowed to get a job. Is it any wonder that we're therefore incentivizing them to, say, seek illegal, unregulated work or abscond on their claim, or, as you know, some people worry about when it comes to things like petty crime, for example, the kind of pickpocketing and things like this. This is in many ways a direct result of our own policy decisions not to allow these people to enter the labour market and benefit from the sort of integration prospects and the income that that provides.
So Alice, just on that point though about processing, do you think it should be easier once someone is found not to be a genuine asylum to then remove them from the country? I think that debate particularly popped up after the recent Liverpool taxi bomb, and so this by a gentleman who, in fact, had claimed asylum in the UK, hadn't been successful, and the government had struggled to deport them. Logic is the amount of legal process and tendencies of a bunch of, I suppose, activist groups to gum up the legal system as much as possible to make sure that no one can ever be deported, even if they don't have a genuine claim. Do you think it would be helpful if it was a bit easier to remove people who don't have a genuine claim and then be more generous to those who do?
Yes, I absolutely think it should be easier to deport people who don't have a legitimate claim. But I think that needs to come hand in hand with massively improving trust in the system. I mean, obviously, things like the Windrush scandal have massively undermined faith in this system. So I think we need almost a complete overhaul of asylum to make sure people can trust the decisions that are made. And if the decision is you don't have a legal claim, then you need to be sent home. But it needs to be a system you can trust.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But I'd also have a note of caution in that there is, in many cases, a good reason to have some of these extra hoops you have to jump through before you, say, deport someone who you don't think has a legitimate claim. If you look at asylum seekers that have appealed decisions against them in the past, say 15, 20 years, around a third of those appeals are successful. And you don't want to end up chucking people out on the basis of, you know, the fact that a third of those appeals are successful. It's kind of concerning that that number is so high. Now, you could argue that perhaps a certain proportion of those successful appeals might be wrong as well. And actually, you know, if we went through another appeals process, then it might turn out that they were wrong again. But it's just important to, yes, speed up the capabilities to send people back to who do not have a legitimate claim for asylum here, but make sure you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater if possible for those legitimate claims that maybe weren't assessed correctly by the Home Office the first time.
Just moving with some of the political issues here, it seems that there was a bit of a claim that as a result of Brexit, immigration would diminish as an issue. And I think it has to some extent, but according to some of the latest polling, it's skyrocketed back up. There does seem to be genuinely a lot of concern about these irregular maritime arrivals, as we used to call them in Australia, or boat arrivals. Is it there a risk that as people are seeing all these undocumented arrivals or arrivals by boat, even if it is, you know, people who are you know, genuine refugees, it is causing more distrust for immigration more broadly, and it's having a kind of negative feedback process on popular support.
Did you want to go for that, Alice, or do you want me to come in?
Yeah, I mean, I think while this tragedy in the Channel, obviously, I think has outraged Britain just because of the human horror of it. But I think a lot of people are angry as well. I think with Brexit, one of the arguments was that we could take back control of our immigration system. We could have, we could open up to the rest of the world, not just the EU. We could be more generous with asylum because we would be in control and we would be able to make those decisions. And I think the scale of these boat arrivals shows how out of control the system is. And as you say, I think it's very much undermining trust in the system as a whole. And I think it's making people feel quite negatively towards asylum seekers. And I think the sooner Boris Johnson and Macron can stop sort of willy waving and actually come to some kind of agreement, the better.
Yeah, the public opinion polling on migration is an interesting one, because there's one that was reported quite widely, a poll that came out last week that looked at public support for some of the harsher measures that the Home Office is considering in the Nationality and Borders Bill. So things like towbacks or exempting border officers from prosecution if their actions result in deaths at sea. Two things that, incidentally, I think will make the situation worse rather than better. But I think it's fair to say that the majority of the population did and do appear to support these sort of measures. But the same poll also found that they don't think that these will be successful at actually reducing the amount of channel crossings. So the kind of situation that I see, at least looking at those two facts, is that there's clearly a lot of concern, specifically, I think, about channel crossings and less so about general migration numbers. I mean, that might be partially because of COVID and the drastically reduced net migration numbers, but I think the focus has become more specifically on channel crossings as opposed to migration as a significant issue in general. But if you look at, say, Refugee Action, who also did some polling on this issue, only 17% of people thought that refugees should be treated differently depending on how they arrive. And that's something that's another key part of the borders bill. So whilst there's support for certainly harsher measures and trying to close down some of the channel crossing routes, there's also a recognition that that's probably not going to work, and that some other measures that the Home Office are looking at doing, the classic one being this kind of two-tiered refugee application system, they're not great fans of it. So it's more of a complicated picture than a simply British public opposes migration, they want to crack down on numbers, and that's that. It's more nuanced.
Yeah, I agree. I think people want to see an immigration system of which our government is in control, and that doesn't seem to be what we have.
Yeah, I think this was a key element, the key theme of the Brexit debate with respect to take back control, that there was a genuine sense of discomfort about the fact that the UK, for better or for worse economically, was open to limitless EU migration and that there were far higher numbers than originally expected. And then this, in a similar sense, I think, is striking a similar tone. I think this is a broader issue, that when people feel like migration is not well controlled, that they don't really know who's coming to the country, and when it's disorderly in this way, there is a big risk of it having this general broader turn against migration. Hence why the government is keen on some of these policies with respect to high skilled immigration at the same time as trying to do what might be perceived historically by UK standards, some quite extreme policies in order to stop the boat crossings, but necessary all the same if you're going to maintain support for popular broader immigration into the UK. But on that note, shall we move on to Boris's blustering?
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been widely accused of a rambling speech to the Confederation of British Industry after losing his place and a lengthy rant about Peppa Pig World. Matthew, I did not watch this speech because, as someone who's barely able to watch Peep Show, I don't think I could have handled the cringe. As someone who I believe did, what did you make of that CBI speech?
I mean, I feel like the ultimate contrarian here when I say I didn't actually think it was that bad. The extent to which it is awful has been massively overblown. I mean, it was very Boris in respect to the fact that, you know, he's making a bunch of broad sweeping claims. It's optimistic. He tells stories. I suppose the awkward moment in the speech was when he clearly lost his place. But I mean, if you were there watching, you could probably almost give, if it wasn't the Prime Minister, you'd just give anyone normal the benefit of the doubt. Or, you know, they lost their place in a speech, whatever. He kind of moved on and kept the audience engaged. It doesn't really worry me too much. The other thing as well, I'll also add, is I didn't actually mind the Peppa Pig World reference, mostly because he's actually making quite a sound free market point. His central point when he was talking about Peppa Pig was the fact that you couldn't have a BBC or civil servants come up with this absurdist, ridiculous global brand. In fact, Peppa Pig was rejected by the BBC, but has now been exported to 180 countries. He's talking about how ultimately, and this is a point, actually a theme that ran throughout the speech, and in contrast to, I guess, a lot of the things that he's recently said, it will be the private sector innovation and entrepreneurialism and that rebounds the British economy. Yes, in a classic Boris way, he was using a less serious example of that with respect to Peppa Pig World, but I didn't think there was anything fundamentally wrong with that. The reason why I actually think to some extent a lot of the media just didn't buy into it was because he was making that pro-market point. They just didn't get it. They just didn't see what he was saying.
And Alice, I noticed that Boris also spoke at the Centre for Policy Studies, the publisher of CapEx, this week. Was that a slightly more welcomed address, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. It was a much friendlier audience, I think, he had here at the CPS Margaret Thatcher Conference. You know, it was sponsored by The Telegraph, his former employer. I was a bit surprised that he recycled his Peppa Pig material after how much it had bombed in the morning. But I've got to say, I agree with Matthew. I actually thought it was quite funny. I liked Picassoid hairdryer. As Matthew is exactly right, he was making this free trade point that Peppa Pig is this international brand and no kind of bunch of bureaucrats could have come up with it. The real problem with the speech wasn't the sort of classic Boris sort of style. It was the lack of content, so that he doesn't have much underpinning it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole irony, of course, that he talks rhetorically about the role of business, but of course he's undertaking the largest tax take in 50, 60, 70 years. So it's not like it's this consistency between some of his rhetoric and some of his actions either.
Yeah, there's something to be said there that actually the big problem is just the lack of content, and we shouldn't worry about the stylistic points of the Prime Minister as much, or in fact we should enjoy them. So maybe I will watch the speech now, given both of your
it's this thing about Boris and his critics never really fully comprehend is that first and foremost he's an entertainer, and a very good entertainer, extraordinarily good. And when the public see him or hear him speak, they hear an entertainer. They hear someone they want to listen to who's not boring like practically every other politician. And it's his number one feature. The problem is, of course, that kind of worked well in a political campaign, but needs some actual meaning to it ultimately. Otherwise, you ending up this situation, I think, with this government, which is that they're just being thrown all over the place because rhetoric alone is not what government means and government needs. Rhetoric is important and effective and will get you elected and keep you in power, but it's not going to fix the problems that need to be addressed.
Yeah, and I think that's a real point about the different audiences he was speaking to that day. So in front of the CBI, he's talking to businesses who've had a terrible pandemic, who've been hit with these high taxes, who were probably hoping for something serious, right? For him to show that he takes them seriously, for him to be speaking at a CPS audience, you know, in front of journalists and policy people is a completely different thing. And for someone who's so kind of in touch with the people, he should understand that really.
And this, all the media criticism that followed came in the light of some rumblings in the Conservative Party of discontent. There was the substantial, though failed, rebellion over social care changes. And there was also a story that came out, which not necessarily completely buying, about a number of MPs sending in no confidence letters. But on the social care changes to start, why is this proving to be such a thorny issue for Boris and the government?
Well, I mean, this is the classic story, isn't it, where Boris has promised a solution to social care, but as we've talked about previously on the podcast, particularly with Eamon, they haven't actually solved anything with social care. They've just said that they're going to raise a bunch of money and get the government to pay a little bit extra for it. Now, the issue with social care became around what would be included and discluded from the cost that people are expected to pay. And Boris made this promise, which I don't think was a good promise and was very unsound policy from a policy perspective, though really smart from a political perspective, which is no one should have to sell their home to fund social care. Then it turns out that you could be asked to pay up to something like £80,000 for the cost of your social care. And if you had very little assets, that might just mean in some circumstances selling your home. Now, personally, I have no issue with that whatsoever, because I think if you have an asset and you've saved, you should also therefore have responsibility to take care of yourself. And because we put so much money in and we've inflated the housing costs so much, largely due to a lack of supply, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with asking wealthier, older people to actually pay a greater contribution towards their social care. Instead, what the government, of course, has done is increase national insurance. So you're asking working age people to pay for the social care of wealthier retirees, which is just a fundamentally unfair proposition and absurd. So Boris got in trouble by just that little bit, just that the extent of just that little bit, which is asking people to make a contribution towards their own social care.
I think one of the problems he has politically here is this kind of new coalition of Conservative voters he's got. So this was controversial because it's particularly going to hit homeowners in the north, where the house has less value in it to to go into social care. You know, people who live in the south where your house is worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, you know, an 86 grand cap isn't really going to affect you that much. And this is part of the Conservative Party's reckoning with its new coalition and with the new kind of shape of British politics, I think.
And what do you, Matthew, make of some of these reports that Number 10 just isn't really functioning after Dominic Cummings left, the idea that it's all kind of fallen apart without the great Dominic Cummings to tie things all together?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is obviously something to this kind of central idea that Boris is a good leader, but a terrible manager, and he needs to hire someone who can do the grunt work and ensure his vision is properly implemented. And that's effectively why he took the total shock of Westminster. No one saw this coming. Brought Dominic Cummings into government to help him get Brexit done. And then also a bunch of kind of post-Brexit agenda items. He also, when he was in City Hall, famously had Eddie Lister, who he brought into Number 10, although has now left Number 10. So it does, you get the impression, at least from a lot of the reporting, that there isn't a kind of leading figure who can keep Boris on track day to day, week to week, and ensure he's focused on delivering. So what you're getting now is the full Boris. So it's just a bit chaotic. It's not particularly well directed. It's very responsive to the media. And you have various factions in Number 10, but kind of vying for influence and power, be it the old advisors from the City Hall days, be it the kind of civil servant group, whoever else it may be. And as a result, no one is there kind of delivering in his best interests. So you effectively need someone who can do that role, someone who's obviously quite senior and capable and influential and pushy and willing to play the system properly. But without that, he's not going to be able to get his agenda done just because of the way government works.
Yeah, I agree with what Matthew says there. Boris seems to be running Downing Street more, and it's a bit of a sort of pundit cliche, but as a court with various different advisors kind of whispering in his ear. I think it's funny that you said to deliver his vision. I'm not sure he's got something as kind of coherent as a vision for the country. I think he's got a lot of sort of individual things he'd like to do. And it's a bit disappointing that some of the bigger policy reforms like around planning and the environment bill still seem to not be making progress.
Well, on that depressing note of disappointment about Boris, let's move on to the final section of today's podcast on babies in Parliament.
Speaker Lindsay Hoyle has ordered an investigation into whether MPs can bring babies into the chamber, following Labour MP Stella Creasy being told it was against the rules to bring her three-month-old into the chamber. Alice, do you think this is a particularly important issue? That there's been some commentary around whether or not this is really kind of quite an elite fascination, how many people are really thinking about bringing their baby into the chambers of Parliament, let alone their normal workplace, and that Creasy is kind of being a little bit self-grandizing by making this such a focus.
I think it's a bit of both. I think how we accommodate working parents is certainly a really important issue, not just for women, but for the whole economy, and there's tremendous waste of productivity and potential that results from women dropping out of the workforce after they have children. And I certainly think that Parliament should be setting a good example. But the fact is, Parliament itself is actually a much better workplace for parents than many others. You know, there's a creche on site. If you want to take maternity leave, there's arrangements for proxy voting, and MPs have large budgets to pay staff to fill the gaps if they're on maternity cover. I do think that this row about a baby in the chamber is, I think it's a very silly move from Parliament. I think it seems like it's a change of rules, because as far as I remember, babies have been being brought into debate since about 2018. If you remember this pairing scandal that Jo Swinson had during a crucial Brexit vote. So anyway, babies have been in the chamber and our democracy hasn't fallen apart. I think parents can be relied on to use a little bit of common sense. There's obviously a difference between like a sleeping three-month-old in a debate who's not going to bother anyone and a screaming toddler who's going to run around distracting everyone. And the fact is, you know, in that case, parents would use, you know, parents of a kind of more practical and less perhaps performative bent would use the on-site nursery for an older child.
I mean, yeah, it always feels a little bit performative when you see these kind of things going in Parliament. Although I don't know why it is still against the rules. Australia, in the Australian Parliament, made a rule change in about 2016, allowing women to bring babies into Parliament. And then there was quite a lot of attention around a mother breastfeeding her 2-month-old in the parliamentary chamber. Now, I think it's really up to the mother to decide what is appropriate in that respect. If they think that their child is well-behaved enough to be brought into that kind of a setting, I don't think it should necessarily be against the rules. Though, Dan, you might have a strongly held different opinion about the decorum in Parliament.
Yeah, no, I need to make sure that there can be absolutely no children in Parliament at all. No, I agree with
you. You just hate children. It's got nothing to do with.
Oh yeah, this is a purely a child like hating children thing. No, I think that the updated rules, and they're very recently updated, I think clearly there's been a mistake made. They say, and they updated in September, I think you shouldn't take your seat in the chamber when accompanied by your child, nor stand at either end of the chamber between divisions. And that is undoubtedly at least a change on what I thought was the norm for several years. Alice, you mentioned Jo Swinson as one of the classic examples, and there's various others in the past few years of MPs that have taken their child into the chamber without incident, without disruption, and it's helped them to manage their lives and make their lives easier. What I would say is that it does kind of speak to a wider problem about effective provision of childcare. Now, in the Commons, it might be the case that actually MPs, you know, they've got an on-site creche and nursery, and until recently they were able to bring their babies into the chamber. Of course, that isn't the case for virtually everyone else in the UK, and MPs are very lucky in some ways to be able to have that that privilege given to them. It's right that they should, but for most mothers, at least in the UK, that's basically impossible. And what ends up happening is you're making the trade-off between staying in work and being able to be a parent, or at least provide effective childcare, much harder. And the main reason for this, of course, is that the UK's childcare regulations are appalling by international standards, and make it very, very difficult for mothers to be able to go back into work and have an affordable means of making sure that their child is well looked after whilst they continue to earn a wage. The kind of classic, the biggest, I think, aspect of these regulations that's caused problems is the carer to child ratios in the UK, which are especially egregious. The idea being that, well, you need to make sure that each child at specific ages under care is getting very good attention, and that, you know, there's not 10 or 20 children per carer, etc. But if you look at various other countries, we are particularly stringent on this, and this drives up costs massively, absolutely massively. There's recent research looking at the US that found that if you relax staff to child ratios by just one infant, that can reduce the cost of childcare by up to a fifth. And given that our childcare costs are so high, and that it doesn't seem like there's that much of a difference on the margins in quality of care by relaxing them, then MPs would probably do well to focus less on things like babies in Parliament and more on things that affect the wider population to a much more significant degree.
Yeah, Danielle's absolutely right. And as I've got a 2-year-old daughter, I'm absolutely on the sharp end of this. And I would also add that the policy of 30 hours free childcare for 3-year-olds is a disaster. So for someone like me with a 2-year-old, it's massively pushed up the costs. My daughter's nursery costs more than a private primary school would. Wow. And, you know, even for a full-time parent of a 3-year-old, the 30 hours free provision isn't enough. And it's also the subsidy that is given to nurseries doesn't cover their costs. So it's putting many nurseries, particularly in deprived areas, out of business. It means very low wages for people who care for our children, who do an incredibly important job. So everything about the government's approach to childcare is wrong-headed. And it, really, they'd be better to have less regulation, less subsidy, more competition and more choice.
I think that's a very important point, Alice, as well, about the costs here. So what we've effectively done is we've regulated extremely low productivity by saying, with these extremely high carer to child ratios, and therefore the wages that are going to be affordable to be paid are going to be much lower. So you're not going to pay childcare workers properly as a result. How do you end up then balancing that kind of work, you know, childcare, raising responsibility? Is it something that must be so difficult if you don't have access to childcare necessarily all the time, or it's extremely expensive? You know, you've got questions. I think for a lot of women, there's probably questions, you know, what's the point in working if I can't get enough of a high enough salary to be able to afford to use childcare?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of women do end up dropping out of the workforce or moving to more part-time work. One thing that's sort of, I think, a double-edged sword as a result of the pandemic is the move towards much more flexible working. I think there's been something like a 5.4% uptick in parents of three-year-olds doing more work because they've been able to do it remotely or from home. And I think in a way, that's a good thing and to be welcome. But in another way, if we're just relying on flexible working, relying on sort of mothers particularly to do sort of an hour here while their kids watching TV, they're not going to be focused. They're not going to be at their most productive. So flexible working is helpful, but it's kind of disguising the underlying problem, which is this problem of affordable childcare.
Yeah. And I suppose then there's also a bit of a gender equity issue. So even though as a woman, you might be able to continue working, it's not really equal in the household quite often. It doesn't seem like men really stand up to provide the level of care that women provide.
Yeah, I think there was an IFS report on how households were kind of sharing work and childcare during the lockdown. And it found that even in situations where a woman was the higher earner, she would still spend more hours combining work and childcare than her partner, even if he wasn't even working. So this is definitely a kind of deep-seated question of gender stereotypes and of the way caring burdens just are not split equally within households and between the genders. That's something with a much more deep-seated and more difficult to solve, I suppose.
I feel like the childcare issue in general is not really discussed as much as it should be, considering how large an impact it has on people's lives. I remember a few years ago, I think Liz Truss mentioned this in passing, looking at the ratios specifically, and that's the last that I've heard of it. Now, this isn't an area that I follow as much as, say, migration that we were talking about earlier, but the impression I certainly get is that this just isn't really on the radar of the government, and certainly not as much as it should be, or indeed a lot of MPs who are concerned with babies in Parliament specifically, as opposed to this thing that affects at least half and the entire British population.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the budget, Rishi Sunak announced sort of several millions for early years for Sure Start centres, but you know, nothing to address the underlying reasons why perhaps some younger children have worse life chances than others, or why early years can be so difficult for families. And this is, I think, of a piece with the government's entire approach. It just seems to be to throw money at things without making proper supply side reforms.
Yep, took the words right out of my mouth there. The throw money at the problem that will go away, whether it's the NHS, whether it's childcare, or whether it's literally any other policy issue in the entire UK. As long as we fund it more, then everything will be wonderful and will be a utopia.
Well, on that note of statism from Daniel, who I thought used to be a small government kind of a guy, but apparently now is obsessed with as big a state as possible. But in all seriousness, thank you very much for tuning in to this episode of the PIM Factory, the Adam Smith Institute's podcast. You'll be listening to me, Matthew Lesh, the head of research at the ASI, and my co-host Daniel Pryor, head of programs, as well as Alice Stemby, who is the deputy editor of CapEx. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe and rate us generously. I recently discovered, actually, we do have quite a lot of positive ratings in the UK system, and in fact, probably a top 5% podcast, something along those lines. So thank you very much to our listeners, and please do tune in again next week for more banter analysis.